Tom Weber on NPR News. A conversation now about closing gaps that we have here in Minnesota, some of the worst racial disparities in the nation. What can cities do this, especially from the business perspective? Some thoughts now from two guests. We're looking for economic equality. Stephen Belton, president and CEO of the Minneapolis Urban League, joins me. Stephen, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
Amelia Moreno Domgaard is a writer, a chef, and a founder of her own business, and brought in this great Guatemalan kitchen cookbook that you wrote. It's a big one, too, so thanks thanks for bringing it in, and thanks for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is actually a conversation, Stephen, that we planned before the election, but it is interesting to just take note that with the election, especially in the cities here yesterday, Minneapolis and St. Paul, you're going to have a much different city council in Minneapolis, to be determined on the mayor race, and then in St. Paul, we'll have a new mayor. What are your thoughts when you think about new city councils, new mayors coming in, about addressing specifically this issue?
One of the first and most important things that business, philanthropic, and government leaders can do to help close disparities, address disparities, and actually eliminate them is by taking a deep dive personally into this issue, to be in owning the issue and understanding and making a commitment to have accurate understanding of what racial inequities are all about. And mm-hmm. I think particularly with the election of Melvin Carter in St. Paul as mayor, but also with the new city council in Minneapolis, you have people who have already made this commitment, who through personal lived experience and through their also through their personal and professional choices have made a commitment to understanding inequity, who are not in denial about racial inequity, who are willing to call it for what it is. And so I'm encouraged by this. It certainly is a historic event for the city of St. Paul. Mm-hmm. I've lived long enough to personally be involved and witness when Minneapolis elected its first African-American mayor. And I know what a boost it is for both for the sense of hope and possibility. And I think that's a platform from which real change can happen.
So when you think about the focus, like, for example, last night I spoke with Jeremiah Ellison, who is in a contested race that will go to a runoff. So he hasn't won yet, but he is leading at this point. He may win a city council race there. And he talked about this. It talked specifically about economic prosperity in communities of color that have been left behind where you see disparities. What exactly are the disparities when we talk about the economics here in the Twin Cities?
Well, we begin with having some of the most disappointing and discouraging income disparities in the nation. And so African Americans, as one group, earn about half, less than half, actually, of what the average white income is in the state of Minnesota. So whites in Minnesota earn approximately $68,000 a year, African Americans about $31,000 a year. And so that is a deep disparity. If you think about that, it's about African Americans earn about 50 cents for every dollar mm-hmm. that whites earn. But it's not just about income. There are health disparities, educational disparities, all of which are social determinants of health. But they're also strong indicators of how a community is doing as well. And I need to say that it even beyond the issue of income, there is the issue of ownership and wealth. And in Minnesota in particular, the wealth gap is quite substantial between African Americans and whites, and it is something that needs to be addressed in tandem with the income disparity.
And that's where business ownership comes in for you, Amelia. As a person of color, did you find – well, just tell us a little bit about your experience in coming up with Amelia LLC, which includes a bunch of different facets of the work you do.
Absolutely. I educate people about eating healthy through culture. I use cuisine as a platform to empower people to health and wellness. And some of the disparities that Stephen has mentioned are also present in the Latino community. Mm-hmm. And roughly 88 cents on the dollar are earned by a male, and roughly 55 of the cents of that are earned by a Latina. There are a lot of disparities that have to do with education. Everything, in my view, boils down to basic education. Mm-hmm. Our systems in the entire United States are outdated. We're not catching up to the current times. And in terms of the makeup of Latinos in the United States of mm-hmm. America,
right.
We have roughly 61% of U.S.-born and 39% immigrants. And why is this important? Because of the approach that you have towards education and employment. Culture is a big component of that. The Latino culture is a collective society versus the U.S. culture is an individualistic society. Collective societies think we society, mm-hmm. Meaning that we make decisions based on the benefit of the whole.
Yeah.
At the same time, collective societies do not encourage entrepreneurship. Things are changing now, but historically that has been the case. So
wow.
When people come from Latin America to these countries, we come from cultural baggage and we have to learn a mm-hmm. new culture or acquire a new culture. And that has to do with education. The two main drivers of growth in the U.S. economy right now are in education and healthcare, and Latinos are underrepresented in general in the United States and in those key sectors as well. And we are underrepresented in schools, and there are not very many Latino teachers that look like me.
Yeah.
And why is that a problem? Because cultural competency is important to connect with Latino immigrants from a language barrier standpoint mm-hmm. and from an understanding from that collective society standpoint.
So when I really want to hone in, if I can, about the collective society versus the individualistic society, because this seems like one of those places where if you've, you know, you came from Guatemala, if someone comes from Latin America or they were just brought up in a Latin American family and culture, that there will be a day when you have to decide how you're going to make a living, right? You have to, you're going to decide how you're going to make money. And the idea of starting your own business, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're saying might not be as prominent in the community. I mean, it's changing too. I don't want to cast a wide net here and stereotype, but then there's the point where you actually have to go to City Hall and get a license, or you have to go through the classes to learn how to open a business. Doesn't seem like they're necessarily tailored to that culture.
I think that it's changing. I think that in my view, from a personal experience, I was fortunate to have access to education in Guatemala as well as higher education here in the United States. So that put me at an advantage, mm-hmm. and I am grateful for that. I had a first career in corporate America, and so I did not jump to entrepreneurship from the get-go. I think that having had experience in corporate America definitely helped me with what I do today. I am a full-time entrepreneur. I started my own business. But I should say also that many immigrants, even though we come with cultural baggage, oftentimes because of out of need, we are propelled to starting businesses.
Right.
And I think that that is changing today. Latinas, for example, are starting businesses at 1.5 times the rate higher of those Latinos in the United States.
Hmm.
And we are, despite the disparities, despite of the economic challenges, we are contributing to the economy some $1.3 billion in economic output. There are some over 3 million businesses created by Latinos here in the United States. So I think that things are changing, but there are a lot of things at the same time that have to change. As well.
We're talking about economic disparities here with Amalia Moreno Domgaard, who founded her own business called Amalia LLC. She's a writer and a chef. She has one of her cookbooks here in the studio with us as well. Stephen Belton from the Minneapolis Urban League here as well. It's so interesting to hear Amalia talk there, Stephen, because, you know, I'm trying to hone in on, we have big picture conversations about this, that, and the other thing, but then it really matters the day you go in to get a permit, right? The day you try to rent this storefront to actually run your business. Those interactions can be the place and usually are the place where this blows up or falls apart. What are the kinds of things that we need to rethink in those avenues to get at some of these disparities?
Well, one, we need to begin to dispel some of the big myths, some of the cultural and racial myths that are out there. And I appreciate Amalia's pointing out the purchasing power of Latinos in particular. I would add to that that by 2018, the demographers say that blacks and Latinos combined will account for almost 20% of total U.S. purchasing power, which is about $3 trillion. And so understanding that this is a viable market and that there's purchasing power in these communities is important. But there are substantial barriers to entrepreneurship, beginning with the fact that you have higher credit, on average, you have lower credit scores, you have less collateral, you have less desirable capital. And even when African-American businesses in particular, and I would project that it's also true of Latino businesses, even when they have collateral, they are paying on average 30% higher in interest rates than their white counterparts. This despite the fact that almost a third of small businesses are owned by people of color. And so you have not only a growing, but you have a present. It's not merely a nascent market, but a present establishment of entrepreneurs in the communities of color, but they do face substantial barriers, and they are regulatory, they are finance, and from our perspective, the root of all of this is structural racism. It's things that are in the institute that are baked into the institutions themselves that are often not even visible to whites and to leaders in particular. Baked into these institutions that are barriers that operate to exclude and to make for an unequal playing field.
But then when that, starting a business, being an entrepreneur, no matter what your race is a very hard endeavor. And there's a lot of failure, frankly, across all races. I just want to clarify what you're saying. You're saying there are other factors over and above the general just difficulty that exists when you're going to start your own business, that exactly and exactingly target communities of color.
Yeah, I think if you talk to entrepreneurs as I have, they wouldn't describe it as hard. They would say it was very demanding, but they love what they're doing, and they're doing it because they're passionate about it, because they have a vision for their business, because they want to be successful, but it is very demanding to do that. But in addition to all the regular demands that are applicable to anyone in there, there are specific challenges and barriers that occur for people of color who are trying to enter business because of their color. They are racially specific barriers. And I mentioned one of them that is access to credit is one of them. You know, the rates for credit that you get them that are available to them. These are all part of the mix that occurs.
How did that translate for you in your own experience, Amalia? Did you find and hit those barriers head on, or was it more subtle?
I started my business gradually, so my experience has been a lot of challenge from my personal standpoint, just challenging myself to do bigger and greater things each time. Being an entrepreneur is not easy. It is definitely very challenging, and it's not for everyone. Otherwise, everyone would be an entrepreneur. As you said, the failure rate is high, and the reason for that differs. Mm-hmm. One of them might be lack of commitment. One of them might be lack of access to capital. Another one may be cultural barriers, and so on. In my viewpoint, my personal experience, I've been an entrepreneur for 12 years now. After I left corporate America, I had the mindset to be successful. And have I made mistakes? Oh my gosh, many. Have I lost money in the process of making a bad decision? Yes. Have I learned from that? Yes. And I learned very quickly. And I learned not to do that again. But I also have the desire to succeed. There might be discrimination around me. I choose mm-hmm. not to see it. If I see a challenge, an obstacle, I go around it and I keep going. And that may come from my corporate background because I was brainwashed in a nice way in business development. I was in the sales area for a long time. And in my opinion, that is one of the best places to be if you are in business because you learn a very good discipline in terms of not letting things go, taking things personally.
Tom, let me give you an example, a quick example, if I may, of the structural challenges that I'm describing. So a lot of entrepreneurs, maybe even most of them, begin by capitalizing their business through home equity. In order to tap into home mm-hmm. equity, you have to be able to own a home.
You put your home up as collateral.
Exactly. But a 2009 study at the University of Minnesota, the Institute on Race and Poverty, found that blacks earning over $150,000 were twice as likely to be denied a home loan as whites earning less than $40,000 a year. So if that's the bear, twice as likely to be denied and they're earning almost three times as much, the likelihood of being able to own a home and therefore capitalize and begin your career in entrepreneurship is structurally lessened mm-hmm. and structurally challenged.
So the opening the business, you have to go back two steps to the day when you couldn't get the loan to buy the house in exactly. the first place. That's what you're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. So when I describe structure, I don't mean just the immediate barriers. I mean looking at the entire system. Mm-hmm. And when I began by saying that one of the challenges and opportunities for our political, business, and philanthropic leaders is to deepen their knowledge and understanding, make a commitment to go beyond the superficial, that's the kind of thing I'm referring to.
And then what? We have so many city council members that were just elected yesterday. Across the state, in municipalities all over Minnesota, they will be in charge of zoning. They'll be in charge of all these things, licensing and things that get people started as business owners. What policy should they be looking at or changing? What are the things they need to go into their own city codes and city charters to look at to address exactly what you've been talking about?
So I think rather than speaking, they need to begin by listening. Mm-hmm. We have a robust infrastructure, an ecosystem of nonprofit organizations, of entrepreneurs like Amalia, lots of people who are working in this field, advocacy organizations like the Minneapolis Urban League, who are out there working this stuff every day and can put them face to face, the policymakers with the people who are trying to provide access, who can provide narrative accounts of the barriers that they have faced and the opportunities that they see in front of them. This is not a complex issue. It doesn't have to be as complex as we often make it, but it begins by putting themselves in listening mode, examining what's already out there and listening to the experts and the operatives who are working on these.
What would you add?
Yes. And if I may say, you know, different kinds of businesses have different structures. And the service-oriented businesses like mine, it's really easy to start a business here in the United States because basically you need a license and you need insurance, liability insurance. And as your business grows, if you go into product development, that is when you need access to capital. Mm-hmm. But by then, you've had a little bit of experience of what it's like to be an entrepreneur, and you've made connections and you have access to certain resources. So in my experience, it has been, you know, fairly workable and fairly easy to establish my business. What is difficult is maintaining and to keep doing bigger things.
Yeah. I hear elected officials. I used to live in St. Louis, Stephen, and I distinctly remember the mayor there talking about how we have decreased the time it takes to get your work permit or your building permit approved, right? You want to add construct, you want to rehab the room or add an addition, and you walk in with your blueprints, you're going to go out with your permit. And it occurs to me hearing you talk that that's step 17 on a whole process of getting to the point where you even might consider needing that addition to the building. And sure, they can speed up the process of step 17, but steps 1 through 16 haven't been addressed.
I agree. And I would say that we also need to be aware that even though this conversation is focused on entrepreneurship and what business can do to address the disparities, entrepreneurship is not for everyone. Our commitment, our focus, primary focus at the Minneapolis Urban League is putting people to work, and we know how to do that. But we need to partner with businesses who need to identify where the growth areas are in the communities and be able to identify what credentials and certifications are necessary, and then help providing designing curriculum so that we are preparing people for the workforce that they need to hire. Because the fact of the matter is that, like it or not, diversity is coming and inclusion will be thrust upon people, or we can welcome it in, because the workforce of tomorrow is increasingly people of color.
Final thoughts here, Amalia. All these people who just got elected yesterday, open mic, what would you say to them in terms of addressing what we've been talking about here today? What's your advice?
I'll say bravo, viva. And we want more Latinos in public office. The time is right. We are progressing to be a majority country very quickly. The time is now. The time is ripe for a Latino to be a mayor or to be in any kind of public office in the Twin Cities and nationally. We want a Latino president.
That's not where I thought you were going to take it, but I appreciate the sentiment, and I thank you very much for being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
For your time. Final thoughts, your few seconds. What's the policy piece? What's the thing, other than listening, what would you tell all those city council members and mayors?
I'd say it's time to convert the election hype into genuine hope and opportunity, and that we are here ready and prepared to engage with you and to work with you. And congratulations.
Stephen Belton, president and CEO of the Minneapolis Urban League, Amalia Moreno-Domgaard, who's a writer and chef, founder of Amalia LLC. Thank you both for being here. I really appreciate it. Obviously, more to talk about, so let's continue the conversation.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for inviting me.
This is NPR News.